A Light on the Road to Woodstock by Ellis Peters. Episode 1. The King's Court was in no hurry to return to England that late autumn of 1120, even though the fighting, somewhat desultory in these last stages, was long over, and the enforced peace sealed by a royal marriage. King Henry had brought to a successful conclusion his 16 years of patient, cunning, relentless plotting, fighting, and manipulating, and could now sit back in high content, master not only of England, but of Normandy too. What the Conqueror had misguidedly dealt out in 2 separate parcels to his 2 elder sons, his youngest son had now put together again, and damped into one. Not without a hand in removing from the light of day, some said, both of his brothers, one of whom had been shovelled into a hasty grave under the tower at Winchester, while the other was now a prisoner in Devizes, and unlikely ever to be seen again by the outer world. The court could well afford to linger to enjoy victory, while Henry trimmed into neatness the last loose edges still to be made secure. But his fleet was already preparing at Barfleur for the voyage back to England, and he would be home before the month ended. Meantime, many of his barons and knights who had fought his battles were withdrawing their contingents and making for home. Among them one Roger Modewit, who had a young and handsome wife waiting for him, certain legal business on his mind, and 25 men to ship back to England, most of them to be paid off on landing. There were 1 or 2 among the miscellaneous riff-raff he had recruited here in Normandy, on his lord's behalf, whom it might be worth keeping on in his own service, along with the few men of his household, at least until he was safely home. The vagabond clerk turned soldier, let him be unfrocked priest or what he might, was an excellent copyist and a sound Latin scholar, and could put legal documents in their best and most presentable form in good time for the King's Court at Woodstock. And the Welsh man-at-arms, blunt and insubordinate as he was also experienced and accomplished in arms, a man of his word, once given, and utterly reliable in whatever situation on land or sea, for in both elements he had long practice behind him. Roger was well aware that he was not greatly loved, and had little faith in either the valour or the loyalty of his own men. But this Welshman, from Gwynedd, by way of Antioch and Jerusalem, and only God knew where else, had imbibed the code of arms, and wore it as a second nature. With or without love, such service as he pledged, that he would provide. Roger put it to them both, as his men were embarking at Barfleur in the middle of a deceptively placid November, and upon a calm sea. "I would have you 2 accompany me to my manor of Sutton Modewit by Northampton when we disembark, and stay in my until a certain lawsuit I have against the Abbey of Shrewsbury is resolved. The King intends to come to Woodstock when he arrives in England, and will be there to preside over my case on the 23rd day of this month. Will you remain in my service until that day?" The Welshman said that he would, until that day, or until the case was resolved. He said it indifferently, as one who has no business of any importance anywhere in the world to pull him in another direction, as well Northampton as anywhere else, as well Woodstock. And after Woodstock, why anywhere in particular? There was no identifiable light beckoning him anywhere along any road. The world was wide, fair and full of savour, but without signposts. Allard, the tatterdemalion clerk, hesitated, scratched his thick thatch of grizzled red hair, and finally also said, "Yes," but as if some vague regret drew him in another direction. It meant pay for some days more. He could not afford to say no. "I would have gone with him with better heart," he said later, when they were leaning on the rail together, watching the low blue line of the English shore rise out of a placid sea, "if he'd been taking a more westerly road." "Why that?" asked Cadval ab Melia ab Davith. "Have you kin in the west?"
"I had once. I have not now."
"Dead?"
"I am the one who died."
Allard heaved lean shoulders in a helpless shrug
and grinned. 57 brothers I had, and now I'm brotherless. I begin to miss my kin now I'm past 40. I never valued them when I was young. He slanted a rueful glance at his companion and shook his head. I was a monk of Evesham, an oblatus, given to God by my father when I was 5 years old. When I was 15, I could no longer abide to live my life in one place, and I ran. Stability is one of the vows we take, to be content in one stay, and go abroad only when ordered. That was not for me, not then. My sort, they call Vagus, frivolous minds that must wander. Well, I've wandered far enough, God knows, in my time. I begin to fear I can never stand still again. The Welshman drew his cloak about him against the chill of the wind. Are you hankering for a return? Even you seamen must drop anchor somewhere at last, said Allard. They'd have my hide if I went back, that I know. But there's this about penance. It pays all debts and leaves the record clear. They find a place for me once I've paid. But I don't know. I don't know. The Vagus is still in me. I'm torn two ways. After 25 years, said Carvin, a month or two more for quiet thinking can do no harm. Copy his papers for him, and take your ease until his business is settled. They were much of an age, though the renegade monk looked the elder by 10 years, and much knocked about by the world he had coveted from within the cloister. It had never paid him well in goods or gear, but he went threadbare and thin. But in wisdom he might have got his fair wages. A little soldiering, a little clerking, some horse-tending, any labour that came to hand, until he could turn his hand to almost anything a hale man can do. He had seen, he said, Italy as far south as Rome, served once for a time under the Count of Flanders, crossed the mountains into Spain, never abiding anywhere for long. His feet still served him, but his mind grew weary of the road. And you, he said, eyeing his companion, whom he had known now for a year in this last campaign, you're something of a Vagus yourself, by your own account. All those years crusading and battling corsairs in the Midland Sea, and still you have not enough of it, but must cross the sea again to get buffeted about Normandy. Had you no better business of your own once you go back to England, but you must enlist again in this muddled melee of a war? No woman to take your mind off fighting? What of yourself? Free of the cloister, free of the vows. Somehow, said Allard, himself puzzled, I never saw it so. A woman here and there, yes, when the heat was on me, and there was a woman by and willing, but marriage and wiving, it never seemed to me I had the right. The Welshman braced his feet on the gently swaying deck and watched the distant shore draw nearer. A broad-set, sturdy, muscular man, in his healthy prime, brown-haired and brown-skinned from eastern suns and outdoor living, well-provided in leather coat and good cloth, and well-armed with sword and dagger. A comely enough face, strongly featured, with the bold bones of his race. There had been women in his time who had found him handsome. I had a girl, he said meditatively, years back, before ever I went crusading. But I left her when I took the cross. Left her for 3 years and stayed away 17. The truth is, in the east I forgot her, and in the west she, thanks be to God, had forgotten me. I did inquire when I got back. She made a better bargain and married a decent, solid man who had nothing of the Vagus in him. A guildsman and councillor at the town of Shrewsbury, no less. So I shed the load from my conscience and went back to what I knew, soldiering, with no regrets, he said simply. It was all over and done years since. I doubt I should have known her again, or she me. There had been other women's faces in the years between, still vivid in his memory, while hers had faded into mist. And what will you do? Asked Allard. Now the king's got everything he wanted,
married his son to Anjou and Maine, and made an end of fighting. Go back to the east? There's never any want of squabbles there to keep a man busy. No, said Cadwal, eyes fixed on the shore that began to show the solidity of land and the undulations of cliff and down. For that, too, was over and done, years since, and not as well done as once he had hoped. This desultory campaigning in Normandy was little more than a postscriptum, an afterthought, a means of filling in the interim between what was past and what was to come, and as yet unrevealed. All he knew of it was that it must be something new and momentous, a door opening into another room. It seems we have both a few days' grace, you and I, to find out where we're going. We'd best make good use of the time. There was stir enough before night to keep them from wondering beyond the next moment or troubling their minds about what was past or what was to come. Their ship put into the roads with a steady and favourable wind and made course into Southampton before the light faded. And there was work for Allard, checking the gear as it was unloaded, and for Cadwal, disembarking the horses. A night's sleep in lodgings and stables in the town, and they would be on their way with the dawn. So the king's due in Woodstock, said Allard, rustling sleepily in his straw in a warm loft over the horses. In time to sit in judgment on the 23rd of the month. He makes his forest lodges the hub of his kingdom. There's more statecraft talked at Woodstock, so they say, than ever at Westminster. And he keeps his beasts there, lions and leopards, even camels. Did you ever see camels, Cadwal, there in the east? Saw them and rode them. Common as horses there, hard-working and serviceable, but uncomfortable riding and foul-tempered. Thank God its horses will be mounting in the morning. And after a long silence, on the edge of sleep, he asked curiously into the straw-scented darkness, If you ever do go back, what is it you want of Evesham? Do I know? Responded Allard drowsily, and followed that with a sudden sharpening sigh, again fully awake. The silence, it might be, or the stillness. To have no more running to do, to have arrived, and have no more need to run. The appetite changes. Now I think it would be a beautiful thing to be still. The manor, which was the head of Roger Modewitt's scattered and substantial honour, lay somewhat southeast of Northampton, comfortably under the lee of the long ridge of wooded hills, where the king had a chase, and spreading its extensive fields over the rich lowland between. The house was of stone and ample, over a deep undercroft, and with a low tower providing two small chambers at the eastern end, and the array of sturdy byres, barns, and stables that lined the containing walls was impressive. Someone had proved a good steward while the lord was away about King Henry's business. The furnishings of the hall were no less eloquent of good management, and the men and maids of the household went about their work with a brisk wariness that showed they went in some awe of whoever presided over their labours. It needed only a single day of watching the Lady Edwina in action to show who ruled the roost here. Roger Modewitt had married a wife not only handsome, but also efficient and masterful. She had had her own way here for 3 years, and by all the signs had enjoyed her dominance. She might even be none too glad to resign her charge now, however glad she might be to have her lord home again. She was a tall, graceful woman, 10 years younger than Roger, with an abundance of fair hair and large blue eyes that went discreetly half-veiled by absurdly long lashes most of the time, but flashed a bright and steely challenge when she opened them fully. Her smile was likewise discreet and almost constant, concealing rather than revealing whatever went on in her mind, and though her welcome to her returning lord left nothing to be desired, but lavished on him every possible tribute of ceremony and affection from the moment his horse entered at the gate, Cadwal could not but wonder whether she was not, at the same time, taking stock of every man he brought in with him, and every article of gear or harness or weaponry in their equipment, as one taking jealous inventory of his goods and resolved to make sure nothing was lacking. She had her little son by the hand, a boy of about 7 years old, and the child had the same fair colouring, the same contained and almost supercilious smile, and was as spruce and fine as his mother. The lady received Allard with a sweeping glance that deprecated his tatterdemalion appearance and doubted his morality, but nevertheless was willing to accept and make use of his abilities. The clerk who kept the manor roll and the accounts was efficient enough, but had no Latin and could not write a good court hand. Allard was whisked away to a small table set in the angle of the great hearth and kept hard at work copying certain charters and letters and preparing them for presentation. "This suit of his is against the Abbey of Shrewsbury," said Allard, freed of his labours after supper in hall. "I recall you said that girl of yours had married a merchant in that town. Shrewsbury is a Benedictine house, like mine of Evesham." "His," he called it still, after so many years of abandoning it, or his again, after time had brushed away whatever division there had ever been. "You must know it if you come from there. I was born in Trevrieux in Gwynedd," said Cadwal. "But I took service early with an English wool merchant who came to Shrewsbury with his household. 14 I was then. In Wales, 14 is manhood. And as I was a good lad with a short bow and took kindly to the sword, I suppose I was worth my keep. The rest of my following years were spent in Shrewsbury. I know it like my own palm, abbey and all. My master sent me there a year and more to get my letters. But I quit that service when he died. I'd pledged nothing to the son, and he was a poor shadow of his father. That was when I took the cross. So did many like me, all afire. I won't say what followed was all ash, but it burned very low at times. It's Modewit who holds this disputed land," said Allard, "and the abbey that sues to recover it. And the thing's been going on 4 years without a settlement, ever since the old man here died. From what I know of the Benedictines, I'd rate their honesty above our Rogers, I'll tell you straight. And yet his charters seem to be genuine, as far as I can tell." "Where is this land they're fighting over?" asked Cadwal. "It's a manor by the name of Rotesley, near Stretton, domain, village, and vowson of the church and all. It seems when the great earl was just dead and his abbey still building, Roger's father gave Rotesley to the abbey. No dispute about that. The charter's there to show it. But the abbey granted it back to him as tenant for life, to live out his latter years there undisturbed, Roger being then married and installed here at Sutton. That's where the dispute starts. The abbey claims it was clearly agreed the tenancy ended with the old man's death, that he himself understood it so, and intended it should be restored to the abbey as soon as he was out of it, while Roger says there was no such agreement to restore it unconditionally, but the tenancy was granted to the Modewits and ought to be hereditary, along to it tooth and claw. After several bearings, they remitted it to the king himself. And that's why you and I, my friend, will be off with his lordship to Woodstock the day after tomorrow." "And how do you rate his chances of success?" "He seems none too sure himself," said Cadwal, "to judge by his short temper and nail-biting this last day or so." "Why, the charter could have been worded better. It says simply that the village is granted back in tenancy during the old man's lifetime, but fails to say anything about what shall happen afterwards, whatever may have been intended. From what I hear, they were on very good terms, Abbot Fulcherid and the old lord. Agreements between them on other matters in the manor book are worded as between men who trusted each other. The witnesses are all of them dead, as Abbot Fulcherid is dead. It's one Godfried now. But for all I know, the abbey may hold letters that have passed between the two, and a letter is witness of intent, no less than a formal charter. All in good time, we shall see." The nobility still sat at the high table, in no haste to retire, Roger brooding over his wine, of which he had already drunk his fair share and more. Cadwal eyed them with interest, seen thus in the family setting. The boy had gone to his bed, hauled away by an elderly nurse, but the Lady Edwina sat in close attendance at her lord's left hand, and kept his cup well filled, smiling her faint, demure smile. On her left sat a very fine young squire of about 25 years, deferential and discreet, with a smile somehow the male reflection of her own. The source of both was secret. The spring of their pleasure or amusement, or whatever caused them so to smile, remained private and slightly unnerving, like the carved stone smiles of certain very old statues Cadwal had seen in Greece long ago. For all his mild, amiable, and ornamental appearance, combed and curled and courtly, he was a big, well-set-up young fellow, with a set to his smooth jaw. Cadwal studied him with interest, for he was plainly privileged here. "Gosselin," said Allard by way of explanation, following his friend's glance. "Her right-hand man, while Roger was away." "Her left-hand man now, by the look of it," thought Cadwal. For her left hand and Gosselin's right were private under the table, while she spoke winningly into her husband's ear. And if those two hands were not paddling palms at this moment, Cadwal was very much deceived. Above and below the drapings of the board were two different worlds. "I wonder," he said thoughtfully, "what she's breathing into Roger's ear now." What the lady was breathing into her husband's ear was, in fact, "You fret over nothing, my lord. What does it matter how strong his proofs, if he never reaches Woodstock in time to present them? You know the law. If one party fails to appear, judgment is given for the other. The assize judges may allow more than one default if they please, but do you think King Henry will? Whoever fails of keeping tryst with him will be felled on the spot. And you know the road by which Prior Heribert must come." Her voice was a silken purr in his ear. "And have you not a hunting lodge in the forest, north of Woodstock, through which that road passes?" Roger's hand had stiffened round the stem of his wine cup. He was not so drunk, but he was listening intently. "Shrewsbury to Woodstock will be a 2 or 3 day journey to such a rider. All you need do is have a watcher on the road north of you to give warning. The woods are thick enough. Masterless men have been known to haunt there. Even if he comes by daylight, your part need never be known. Hide him but a few days. It will be long enough. Then turn him loose by night. And who's ever to know what footpads held and robbed him? You need not even touch his parchments. Robbers would count them worthless. Take what common thieves would take, and theirs will be the blame." Roger opened his tight-shut mouth to say in a doubtful growl, "You'll not be travelling alone." "Ah, 2 or 3 abbey servants. They'll run like hares. You need not trouble yourself over them. 3 stout, silent men of your own will be more than enough." He brooded, and began to think so too, and to review in his mind the men of his household, seeking the right hands for such work, not the Welshman and the clerk, the strangers here. Their part was to be the honest onlookers, in case there should ever be questions asked. They left Sutton Modewood on the 20th day of November, which seemed unnecessarily early, though, as Roger had decreed that they should settle in his hunting lodge in the forest close by Woodstock, which meant conveying stores with them to make the house habitable and provision it for a party for, presumably, a stay of 3 nights at least, it was perhaps a wise precaution. Roger was taking no chances in his suit, he said. He meant to be established on the ground in good time, and have all his proofs in order. "But so he has," said Allard, pricked in his professional pride. "For I've gone over everything with him, and the case, if open in default of specific instructions, is plain enough, and will stand up. What the abbey can muster, who knows? They say the abbot is not well, which is why his prior comes in his place. My work is done." He had the faraway look in his eye, as the party rode out and faced westward, of one either penned and longing to be where he could but see, or loose and weary and being drawn home. Either a Vargas escaping outward, or a penitent, flying back in haste before the doors should close against him. There must indeed be something desirable and lovely to cause a man to look towards it with that look on his face. 3 men-at-arms and 2 grooms accompanied Roger, in addition to Allard and Cadwal, whose term of service would end with the session in court, after which they might go where they would. Cadwal horsed, since he owned his own mount, Allard afoot, since the pony he rode belonged to Roger. It came as something of a surprise to Cadwal that the squire Gosselin should also saddle up and ride with the party, very debonair, and well armed with sword and dagger. "I marvel," said Cadwal dryly, "that the lady doesn't need him at home for her own protection while her lord's absent." The Lady Edwina, however, bade farewell to the whole party with the greatest serenity, and to her husband with demonstrative affection, putting forward her little son to be embraced and kissed. "Perhaps," thought Cadwal, relenting, "I do her wrong, simply because I feel chilled by that smile of hers. For all I know, she may be the truest wife living." They set out early, and before Buckingham made a halt at the small and penurious priory of Bradwell, where Roger elected to spend the night, keeping his 3 men-at-arms with him, while Gosselin, with the rest of the party, rode on to the hunting lodge to make all ready for their lord's reception the following day. It was growing dark by the time they arrived, and the bustle of kindling fire and torches and unloading the bed linen and stores from the sumpter ponies went on into the night. The lodge was small, stockaded, well furnished with stabling and mews, and in thick woodland, a place comfortable enough once they had a roaring fire on the hearth and food on the table. "The road the Prior of Shrewsbury will be coming by," said Allard, warming himself by the fire after supper, "passes through Evesham, and like as not, they'll stay the last night there." With every mile west, Cadwal had seen him straining forward with mounting eagerness. "The road cannot be far away from us here. It passes through this forest." "It must be nearly 30 miles to Evesham," said Cadwal. "A long day's riding for a clerical party. It will be night by the time they ride past into Woodstock. If you're set on going, stay at least to get your pay, for you'll need it before the 30 miles is done." They went to their slumber in the warmth of the hall, without a word more said. But he would go, Allard, whether he himself knew it yet or not. Cadwal knew it. His friend was a tired horse with the scent of the stable in his nostrils. Nothing would stop him now until he reached it. It was well into the middle of the day when Roger and his escort arrived, and they approached, not directly, as the advance party had done, but from the woods to the north, as though they had been indulging in a little hunting or hawking by the way, except that they had neither hawk nor hound with them. A fine, clear, cool day for riding. There was no reason in the world why they should not go roundabout for the pure pleasure of it. And indeed, they seemed to come in high content. But that Roger's mind had been so preoccupied and so anxious concerning his lawsuit that distraction seemed unlikely. Cadwal was given to thinking about unlikely developments, which from old campaigns he knew to prove significant in most cases. Gosselin, who was out at the gate to welcome them in, was apparently oblivious to the direction from which they came. That way lay Allard's highway to his rest. But what meaning ought it to have for Roger Modewitt? The table was lavish that night, and lord and squire drank well and ate well, and gave no sign of any care, though they might, Cadwal thought, watching them from his lower place, seem a little tight and knife-edged. Well, the King's Court could account for that. Shrewsbury's prior was drawing steadily nearer, with whatever weapons he had for the battle. But it seemed rather an exultant tension than an anxious one. Was Roger counting his chickens already? The morning of the 22nd of November dawned, and the noon passed. And with every moment, Allard's restlessness and abstraction grew, until with evening it possessed him utterly, and he could no longer resist. He presented himself before Roger after supper, when his mood might be mellow from good food and wine. "My lord,
With the morrow, my service to you is completed. You need me no longer. And with your goodwill, I would set forth now for where I'm going. I go afoot and need provision for the road. If you have been content with my work, pay me what is due and let me go. It seemed that Roger had been startled out of some equally absorbing preoccupation of his own, and was in haste to return to it, for he made no demur, but paid at once. To do him justice, he had never been a grudging paymaster. He drove as hard a bargain as he could at the outset, but once the agreement was made, he kept it. "Go when you please," he said. "Fill your bag from the kitchen for the journey when you leave. You did good work, I give you that." And he returned to whatever it was that so engrossed his thoughts, and Allard went to collect the proffered largesse and his own meagre possessions. "I'm going," he said, meeting Cadvar in the hall doorway. "I must go." There was no more doubt in voice or face. "They will take me back, though in the lowest place. From that there's no falling. The blessed Benedict wrote in the rule that even to the third time of straying, a man may be received again if he promise full amendment." It was a dark night, without moon or stars, but in fleeting moments, when the wind ripped apart the cloud covering to let through a brief gleam of moonlight. The weather had grown gusty and wild in the last 2 days. The king's fleet must have had a rough crossing from Barfleur. "You'd do better," urged Cadvar, "to wait for morning and go by daylight. Here's a safe bed, and the king's peace, however well enforced, hardly covers every mile of the king's high roads." But Allard would not wait. The yearning was on him too strongly, and a penniless vagabond who had ventured all the roads of Christendom by day or night was hardly likely to flinch for the last 30 miles of his wanderings. "Then I'll go with you as far as the road and see you on your way," said Cadvar. There was a mile or two of track through thick forest between them and the high road that bore away west-northwest on the upland journey to Evesham. The ribbon of open highway, hemmed on both sides by trees, was hardly less dark than the forest itself. King Henry had fenced in his private park at Woodstock to house his wild beasts, but maintained also his hunting chase here many miles in extent. At the road they parted, and Cadvar stood to watch his friend march steadily away towards the west, eyes fixed ahead, upon his penance and his absolution. A tired man with a rest assured. Cadvar turned back towards the lodge as soon as the receding shadow had melted into the night. He was in no haste to go in, for the night, though blustery, was not cold, and he was in no mind to seek the company of others of the party, now that one best known to him was gone, and gone in so mysteriously rapt a fashion. He walked on among the trees, turning his back on his bed for a while. The constant thrashing of branches in the wind all but drowned the scuffling and shouting that suddenly broke out behind him, at some distance among the trees, until a horse's shrill whinny brought him about with a jerk, and set him running through the underbrush towards the spot where confused voices yelled alarm and broken bushes thrashed. The clamour seemed some little way off, and he was startled as he shouldered his way headlong through thicket to collide heavily with two entangled bodies, sent them spinning apart, and himself fall asprawl upon one of them in the flattened grass. The man under him uttered a scared and angry cry, and the voice was Roger's. The other man made no sound at all, but slid away very rapidly and lightly to vanish among the trees, a tall shadow swallowed in shadows. Cadvar drew off in haste, reaching an arm to hoist the wounded man. "My lord, are you hurt? What in God's name is to do here?" The sleeve he clutched slid warm and wet under his hand. "You're injured. Hold fast. Let's see what harm's done before you move." Then there was the voice of Gosselin, for once loud and vehement and alarm, shouting for his lord and crashing headlong through bush and brake to fall on his knees beside Roger, lamenting and raging. "My lord, my lord! What happened here? What rogues were those loose in the woods? Dared they waylay travellers so close to the king's highway? You're hurt! Here's blood!" Roger got his breath back and sat up, feeling at his left arm below the shoulder and wincing. "A scratch. My arm. God curse him, whoever he may be. The fellow struck for my heart. Man, if you had not come charging like a bull, I might have been dead. You hurled me off the point of his dagger. Thank God there's no great harm. But I bleed. Help me back home.
That a man may not walk by night in his own woods,
fumed Gosselin, hoisting his lord carefully to his feet, without being set upon by outlaws.
Help here, you, Cadvile. Take his other arm. Footpads so close to Woodstock. Tomorrow we must turn out the watch to comb these tracks and hunt them out of cover before they kill.
Get me within doors, snapped Roger, and have this coat and shirt off me. And let's staunch this bleeding. I'm alive. That's the main. They helped him back between them, through the more open ways towards the lodge. It dawned on Cadval as they went that the clamour of furtive battle had ceased completely. Even the wind had abated. And somewhere on the road distantly, he caught the rhythm of galloping hooves, very fast and light, as of a riderless horse in panic flight. The gash in Roger Modewitt's left arm, just below the shoulder, was long but not deep, and grew shallower as it descended. The stroke that marked him thus could well have been meant for his heart. Cadfael's hurtling impact, at the very moment the attack was launched, had been the means of averting murder. The shadow that had melted into the night had no form. Nothing about it rendered it human or recognizable. He had heard an outcry and run towards it, a projectile to strike attacked and attacker apart. Questioned, that was all he could say. For which, said Roger, bandaged and resting and warmed with mulled wine, he was heartily thankful. And indeed, Roger was behaving with remarkable fortitude and calm for a man who had just escaped death. By the time he had demonstrated to his dismayed grooms and men-at-arms that he was alive and not much the worse, appointed the hour when they should set out for Woodstock in the morning, and been helped to his bed by Gosselin, there was even a suggestion of complacency about him, as though a gash in the arm was a small price to pay for the successful retention of a valuable property and a defeat of his clerical opponents. In the court of the palace of Woodstock, the king's chamberlains, clerks, and judges were fluttering about in a curiously distracted manner, or so it seemed to Cadfael, standing apart among the commoners to observe their antics. They gathered in small groups, conversing in low voices and with anxious faces, broke apart to regroup with others of their kind, hurried in and out among the litigants, avoiding or brushing off all questions, exchanged documents, hurried to the door to peer out, as if looking for some late arrival. And there was indeed one litigant who had not kept to his time, for there was no sign of a Benedictine prior among those assembled, nor had anyone appeared to explain or justify his absence. And Roger Modewitt, in spite of his stiff and painful arm, continued to relax, with ever-increasing assurance, into shining complacency. The appointed hour was already some minutes past, when four agitated fellows, two of them Benedictine brothers, made a hasty entrance and accosted the presiding clerk.
"Sir," bleated the leader, loud in nervous dismay, "we here are come from the Abbey of Shrewsbury, escort to our prior, who was on his way to plead a case at law here. Sir, you must hold him excused, for it is not his blame nor ours that he cannot appear. In the forest, some 2 miles north, as we rode hither last night in the dark, we were attacked by a band of lawless robbers, and they have seized our prior and dragged him away."
The spokesman's voice had risen shrilly in his agitation. He had the attention of every man in the hall by this time. Certainly he had Cadvile's. Masterless men some 2 miles out of Woodstock, plying their trade last night, could only be the same who had happened upon Roger Modewitt, and all but been the death of him. Any such gang so close to the court was astonishing enough. There could hardly be two. The clerk was outraged at the very idea.
"Seized and captured him? And you four were with him? Can this be true? How many were they who attacked you?"
"We could not tell for certain. 3 at least. But they were lying in ambush. We had no chance to stand them off. They pulled him from his horse and were off into the trees with him. They knew the woods and we did not. Sir, we did go after them, but they beat us off."
It was evident they had done their best, for 2 of them showed bruised and scratched, and all were soiled and torn as to their clothing.
We have hunted through the night, but found no trace. Only we caught his horse a mile down the highway as we came hither. So we plead here that our prior's absence be not seen as a default. For indeed, he would have been here in the town last night, if all had gone as it should.
Hush! Wait! Said the clerk, peremptorily.
All heads had turned towards the door of the hall, where a great flurry of officials had suddenly surged into view, cleaving through the press with fixed and ominous haste, to take the centre of the floor, below the king's empty dais. A chamberlain, elderly and authoritative, struck the floor loudly with his staff and commanded silence. And at sight of his face, silence fell like a stone.
My lords, gentlemen, all who have pleas here this day, and all others present, you are bidden to disperse, for there will be no hearings today. All suits that should be heard here must be postponed 3 days, and will be heard by His Grace's judges. His Grace the King cannot appear.
This time the silence fell again like a heavy curtain, muffling even thought or conjecture.
The court is in mourning from this hour. We have received news of desolating import. His Grace, with the greater part of his fleet, made the crossing to England safely, as is known. But the Blanche Nef, in which His Grace's son and heir, Prince William, with all his companions and many other noble souls, were embarked, put to sea late, and was caught in gales before ever clearing Barfleur. The ship is lost, split upon a rock, foundered with all hands. Not a soul is come safe to land. Go hence quietly and pray for the souls of the flower of this realm.
So, that was the end of one man's year of triumph. An empty achievement. A ruinous victory. Normandy won, his enemies routed, and now everything swept aside, broken apart upon an obstinate rock, washed away in a malicious sea. His only lawful son, recently married in splendour, now denied even a coffin and a grave. For if ever they found those royal bodies, it would be by the relenting grace of God, for the sea seldom put its winnings ashore by Barfleur. Even some of his unlawful sons, of whom there were many, gone down with their royal brother. No one left but the one legal daughter to inherit a barren empire. Tadvile walked alone in a corner of the king's park and considered the foolishness of mortal vainglory that was paid for with such a bitter price. But also he thought of the affairs of little men, to whom even a luckless king owed justice. For somewhere there was still to be sought the lost prior of Shrewsbury, carried off by masterless men in the forest, a litigant who might still be lost 3 days hence, when his suit came up again for hearing, unless someone, in the meantime, knew where to look for him. He was in little doubt now. A lawless gang at liberty, so close to a royal palace, was in any case unlikely enough, and Cadfael was liable to brood on the unlikely. But that there should be two, no, that was impossible. And if one only, then that same one, whose ambush he had overheard at some distance, yet close enough, too close for comfort, to Roger Modewitt's hunting lodge. Probably the unhappy brothers from Shrewsbury were off beating the wilds of the forest afresh. Cadfael knew better where to look. No doubt Roger was biting his nails in some anxiety over the delay, but he had no reason to suppose that 3 days would release the captive to appear against him, nor was he paying much attention to what his Welsh man-at-arms was doing with his time. Cadfael took his horse and rode back, without haste, towards the hunting lodge. He left in the early dusk, as soon as the evening meal was over in Modewitt's lodging. No one was paying any heed to him by that time of day. All Roger had to do was hold his tongue and keep his wits about him for 3 days.
and the disputed manor would still be adjudged to him. Everything was beautifully in hand, after all. Two of the men-at-arms and one groom had been left behind at the hunting lodge. Cadval doubted if the man they guarded was to be found in the house itself. For unless he was blindfolded, he would be able to gather far too much knowledge of his surroundings, and the fable of the masterless men would be tossed into the rubbish heap. No, he would be held in darkness, or dim light at best, even during the day, in straw or the rush flooring of a common hut, fed adequately but plainly and roughly, as wild men might keep a prisoner they were too cautious to kill or too superstitious, until they turned him loose in some remote place, stripped of everything he had of value. On the other hand, he must be somewhere securely inside the boundary fence, otherwise there would be too high a risk of his being found. Between the gate and the house, there were trees enough to obscure the large holding of a man of consequence. Somewhere among the stables and barns, or the now empty kennels, there he must be held. Cadval tethered his horse and cover well aside from the lodge and found himself a perch in a tall oak tree, from which vantage point he could see over the fence into the courtyard. He was in luck. The three within fed themselves at leisure before they fed their prisoner, preferring to wait for dark. By the time the groom emerged from the hall with a pitcher and a bowl in his hands, Cadval had his night eyes. They were quite easy about their charge, expecting no interference from any man. The groom vanished momentarily between the trees within the enclosure, but appeared again at one of the low buildings tucked under the fence, set down his pitcher for a moment, while he hoisted clear a heavy wooden bar that held the door fast shut, and vanished within. The door thudded to after him, as though he had slammed it shut with his back braced against it, taking no chances, even with an elderly monastic. In a few minutes he emerged again empty-handed, hauled the bar into place again, and returned, whistling, to the hall and the enjoyment of Modewitz ale. Not the stables nor the kennels, but a small, stout hay store, built on short wooden piles raised from the ground. At least the prior would have fairly snug lying. Cadval let the last of the light fade before he made a move. The wooden wall was stout and high, but more than one of the old trees outside leaned a branch over it, and it was no great labour to climb without and drop into the deep grass within. He made first for the gate and quietly unbarred the narrow wicket set into it. Faint threads of torchlight filtered through the chinks in the hall shutters, but nothing else stirred. Cadval laid hold of the heavy bar of the storehouse door and eased it silently out of its socket, opening the door by cautious inches and whispering through the chink, "Father!" There was a sharp rustling of hay within, but no immediate reply.
"Father Prayer, is it you? Softly, are you bound?"
A hesitant and slightly timorous voice said,
"No."
And in a moment, with better assurance,
"My son, you are not one of these sinful men."
"Sinful man I am, but not of their company."
"Hush, quietly now. I have a horse close by. I came from Woodstock to find you. Reach me your hand, father, and come forth."
A hand came wavering out of the hay-scented darkness to clutch convulsively at Cadval's hand. The pale patch of a tonsured crown gleamed faintly, and a small rounded figure crept forth and stepped into the thick grass. He had the wit to waste no breath then on questions, but stood docile and silent while Cadval rebarred the door on emptiness, and, taking him by the hand, led him softly along the fence to the unfastened wicket and the great gate. Only when the door was closed as softly behind them did he heave a great, thankful sigh. They were out. It was done. And no one would be likely to learn of the escape until morning. Cadval led the way to where he had left his horse tethered. The forest lay serene and quiet about them.
"You ride, father.
and I'll walk with you. It's no more than 2 miles into Woodstock. We're safe enough now. Bewildered and confused by so sudden a reversal, the prior confided and obeyed like a child. Not until they were out on the silent high road did he say sadly, "I have failed of my mission. Son, may God bless you for this kindness, which is beyond my understanding. For how did you know of me, and how could you divine where to find me? I understand nothing of what has been happening to me, and I'm not a very brave man. But my failure is no fault of yours, and my blessing I owe you without stint." "You have not failed, father," said Cadwal simply. "The suit is still unheard, and will be for 3 days more. All your companions are safe in Woodstock, except that they fret and search for you. And if you know where they will be lodging, I would recommend that you join them now, by night, and stay well out of sight until the day the case is heard. For if this trap was designed to keep you from appearing in the king's court, some further attempt might yet be made. Have you your evidences safe? They did not take them?"
"Brother Orderic, my clerk, was carrying the documents, but he could not conduct the case in court. I only am accredited to represent my abbot. But, my son, how is it that the case still goes unheard? The king keeps strict day and time, it's well known. How comes it that God and you have saved me from disgrace and loss?"
"Father, for all too bitter reason, the king could not be present."
Cadwal told him the whole of it. How half the young chivalry of England had been wiped out in one blow, and the king left without an heir. Prior Heribert, shocked and dismayed, fell to praying in a grieving whisper for both dead and living, and Cadwal walked beside the horse in silence. For what more was there to be said? Except that King Henry, even in this shattering hour, willed that his justice should still prevail, and that was virtue in any monarch. Only when they came into the sleeping town did Cadwal again interrupt the prior's fervent prayers with a strange question. "Father, was any man of your escort carrying steel? A dagger? Or any such weapon?"
"No, no. God forbid,"
said the prior, shocked.
"We have no use for arms. We trust in God's peace, and after it, in the king's."
"So I thought," said Cadwal, nodding. "It is another discipline for another venture."
By the change in Modewitt's countenance, Cadfael knew the hour of the following day when the news reached him that his prisoner was flown. All the rest of that day he went about with nerves at stretch and ears pricked for any sensational rumours being bandied around the town, and eyes roving anxiously in dread of the sight of Prior Heribert in court or street, braced to pour out his complaint to the king's officers. And as the hours passed, and still there was no sign, he began to be a little eased in his mind, and to hope still for a miraculous deliverance. The Benedictine brothers were seen here and there, mute and somber-faced. Surely they could have no word of their superior. There was nothing to be done but set his teeth, keep his countenance, wait, and hope. The second day passed, and the third day came, and Modewitt's hopes had soared again, for still there was no word. He made his appearance before the king's judge confidently, his charters in hand. The abbey was the suitor. If all went well, Roger would not even have to state his case, for the plea would fail of itself, when the pleader failed to appear. It came as a shattering shock when a sudden stir at the door, prompt to the hour appointed, blew into the hall a small, round, unimpressive person in the Benedictine habit, hugging to him an armful of vellum rolls, and followed by his black-gowned brothers in close attendance. Cadfael, too, was observing him with interest, but it was the first time he had seen him clearly. A modest man of comfortable figure and amiable countenance, rosy and mild, not so old as that night journey had suggested, perhaps 45, with a shining innocence about him. But to Roger Modewitt, it might have been a fire-breathing dragon entering the hall. And who would have expected, from that gentle, even deprecating presence, the clarity and expertise with which that small man deployed his original charter, punctiliously identical to Roger's according to the account Allard had given, and omitting any specific mention of what should follow Arnulf Modewitt's death. How scrupulously he pointed out the omission and the arguments to which it might give rise, and followed it up with two letters written by that same Arnulf Modewitt to Abbot Fulchered, referring in plain terms to the obligatory return of the manor and village after his death, and pledging his son's loyal observance of the obligation. It might have been in want of proofs that caused Roger to make so poor a job of refuting the evidence, or it might have been craven conscience. Whatever the cause, judgment was given for the abbey. Cadfael presented himself before the lord he was leaving, barely an hour after the verdict was given. "My lord, your suit is concluded, and my service with it. I have done what I pledged. Here I part from you." Roger sat sunk in gloom and rage, and lifted upon him a glare that should have felled him, but failed of its impact. "I misdoubt me," said Roger, smouldering, "how you have observed your loyalty to me. Who else could know?" He bit his tongue in time. For as long as it remained unsaid, no accusation had been made, and no rebuttal was needed. He would have liked to ask, "How did you know?" But he thought better of it. "Go then, if you have nothing more to say." "As to that," said Cadfael meaningly, "nothing more need be said. It's over." And that was recognizable as a promise, but with uneasy implications, for plainly on some other matter he still had a thing to say. "My lord, give some thought to this, for I was until now in your service and wish you no harm. Of those four who attended Prior Heribert on his way here, not one carried arms. There was neither sword nor dagger nor knife of any kind among the five of them." He saw the significance of that go home, slowly, but with bitter force. The masterless men had been nothing but a children's tale, but until now, Roger had thought, as he had been meant to think, that that dagger stroke in the forest had been a bold attempt by an abbey servant to defend his prior. He blinked and swallowed and stared and began to sweat, beholding a perilous gulf into which he had all but stumbled. "There were none there who bore arms," said Cadfael, "but your own." A double-edged ambush that had been, to have him out in the forest by night, all unsuspecting, and there were as many miles between Woodstock and Modewitt returning as coming, and there would be other nights as dark on the way. "Who?" asked Roger in a grating whisper. "Which of them? Give me a name." "No," said Cadfael simply. "Do your own divining. I am no longer in your service. I have said all I mean to say." Roger's face had turned grey. He was hearing again the plan unfolded so seductively in his ear.
"You cannot leave me so. If you know so much, for God's sake, return with me. See me safely home, at least. You who I could trust."
"No," said Cadfael again.
"You are warned. Now guard yourself."
It was fair, he considered. It was enough. He turned and went away without another word. He went, just as he was, to Vespers in the parish church, for no better reason, or so he thought then, than that the dimness within the open doorway beckoned him as he turned his back on a duty completed, inviting him to quietness and thought. And the bell was just sounding. The little prior was there, ardent in thanksgiving,
One more creature who had fumbled his way to the completion of a task and the turning of a leaf in the book of his life. Cadfael watched out the office and stood mute and still for some time after priest and worshippers had departed. The silence after their going was deeper than the ocean and more secure than the earth. Cadfael breathed and consumed it like new bread. It was the light touch of a small hand on the hilt of his sword that startled him out of that profound isolation. He looked down to see a little acolyte, no higher than his elbow, regarding him gravely from great round eyes of blinding blue, intent and challenging, as solemn as ever was, angelic messenger.
"Sir,"
said the child, in stern treble reproof, tapping the hilt with an infant finger,
"should not all weapons of war be laid aside here?"
"Sir," said Cadfael, hardly less gravely, though he was smiling, "you may very well be right."
And slowly he unbuckled the sword from his belt and went and laid it down, flatlings, on the lowest step under the altar. It looked strangely appropriate and at peace there. The hilt, after all, was a cross. Prior Heribert was at a frugal supper with his happy brothers in the parish priest's house when Cadfael asked audience with him. The little man came out graciously to welcome a stranger, and knew him for an acquaintance at least, and now at a breath, certainly a friend.
"You, my son! And surely it was you at Vespers. I felt that I should know the shape of you. You are the most welcome of guests here, and if there is anything I and mine can do to repay you for what you did for us, you need but name it."
"Father," said Cadfael, briskly Welsh in his asking, "do you ride for home tomorrow?"
"Surely, my son. We leave after prime. Abbot Gottfried will be waiting to hear how we have fared."
"Then, father, here am I at the turning of my life, free of one master's service, and finished with arms. Take me with you."
That was A Light on the Road to Woodstock by Ellis Peters. It was read by Nigel Anthony and produced by Joanne Reid.